Previously on Rewind or Die.
Welcome to the firm, where the action scene is a guy furiously making copies at a Kinko's.
It's a thriller where Tom Cruise looks increasingly alarmed at office furniture.
They gave him a BMW, a house, and a one-way ticket to Brimley Hell.
Candlebox had 1.5 hits, Jeff. 1.5.
Was the half hit you, Change, Cover Me? Because if you know more than 2 Candlebox songs, you're in the band.
Wilfred Brimley shows up like a cardigan-wrapped threat.
This is a spreadsheet noir, Jeff!
It's not a plot. It's an HR violation with music.
This movie made me sweat during a file sort.
Hopefully we edit this out.
We edit nothing?
Tuna feels like perjury in a tin.
Try the Moral Gray Mojito. Now, with 50% more plausible deniability.
Welcome, Works. Because discretion isn't optional, it's policy. And now, the show.
Okay, before we dive any deeper into this torpedo tube of a movie, Jeff, are you wearing a Navy ship's baseball cap right now?
Yes, the USS Ranger, decommissioned in 93, served in Vietnam, also doubled as the aircraft carrier Enterprise in Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. You know, the time travel whale one.
First, wait, hold on, let me process this. So you're telling me that hat you're wearing is from a real Navy ship that pretended to be a fake sci-fi ship in a movie where Spock mind melds with a whale and Scotty talks to a computer mouse?
Yep, a nuclear vessel, if you will.
I can't. You're wearing cosplay propaganda. That's a ship that LARPs. It roleplayed as the future to help time-traveling Vulcans stop a space probe from vaporizing the oceans.
Technically, the Ranger has more screen credits than Rob Schneider. I swear, if you look close enough, that ship is in the background of Pearl Harbor, Sequest DSV, and Waterworld.
It's the Daniel Day-Lewis of boats.
It's called Range. Rangers got range.
Oh my God, put it in the credits. Special guest star, the USS Ranger, as that one ship that's also every other ship. Give it a monologue. Give it an Emmy.
Give it a sitcom spinoff. Nuclear Wessel and Me. Tuesdays at 8 on ABC.
Okay, but Jeff, can we also take a second to acknowledge that you finally accepted the theme song?
I didn't hate it. I just said it sounded like Bob Seger got recruited by the Pentagon.
Yes, it's classic rock paranoia. It's turn the page, but the page is a launch code. And the guitar solo is sweating profusely in international waters.
I think it sounds like Sammy Hagar scoring a documentary about Cold War radar pings.
It's dad rock with clearance. I've made peace with it.
Thank you. Now we're operating as a unit. All right. Before we start quoting Dr. Jillian Taylor and yelling, "Hello, computer," into a Wacom tablet, let me actually introduce this brave little crew before we submerge. I'm Adam, your captain of chaos. Unlicensed, unqualified, emotionally compromised. I make all my command decisions based on who sweats the least during moral arguments. Joining me, as always, is Jeff, our resident expert on Cold War protocol, Starfleet cameos, and which ships have secretly appeared in more movies than Alan Tudyk.
You're welcome.
He once corrected a naval historian on the technical specs of the USS Excelsior in person at a funeral. And of course, Steve is here too. He's in the back of the sub, quietly disabling the warheads and replacing them with expired Arby's coupons and loose Nintendo cartridges.
Roast beef brings peace.
He's single-handedly ending the Cold War using crinkle fries and misplaced Game Boy saves. All right, let's get into Crimson Tide, a film where Hackman brings the thunder, Denzel brings the brains, and everyone's pores are working overtime. One boat, two legends, zero chill.
As you no doubt heard, my exo has appendicitis. Your name was at the top of the list.
That's good to know, sir.
It was a short list.
There's trouble in Russia. So they called us. And we're going over there and bringing the most lethal killing machine ever devised. The last time we hit this state of emergency was 32 and a half years ago during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So this is what it's all about, gentlemen. It's what we train for.
Submerge the ship.
Diving officer, submerge the ship. Make your depth 150 feet.
On the 1MC. Dive, dive.
This year,
we have a properly formatted emergency action message from National Command Authority.
What we've always known.
Bravo, Echo, Echo, Charlie, Alpha.
Becomes what we've always feared.
Gentlemen, this is the captain. Russian rebels have threatened to launch against our country and are fueling right now.
This is not a drill.
Now.
Sir, we have a possibly submerged submarine.
You find out who that is.
Receiving emergency action message. Recommend alert one.
The battle for survival begins.
That's a message fragment.
Sir, we don't know what this message means. Our target package could have changed.
I've made a decision.
There's no place for fear.
He's lost his nerve.
I'd rather go out myself and get this one wrong.
There's no room for mistakes.
If we launch and we're wrong, what's left of Russia is going to launch at us.
I'm captain of this boat. I don't have to think this over.
There's no time for doubt.
The missile system's ready to launch. In 6 minutes.
You repeat this order or I'll find somebody who will.
Hell no, you won't, sir.
And nothing can stop the tide.
Come on, sonar, torpedoes in the water!
Right forward!
1,000 yards of closing dive! Make your depth 1,200 feet!
Hang on, everybody!
We cannot launch our missiles unless both you and I agree.
Fire! They're fueling our missiles!
He's right on top of us!
Please, Commando!
Captain.
Under arrest on a charge of mutiny!
Lock Captain Ramsey in his stateroom.
Fire one! Now!
Give me the missile key, Mr. Hunter.
Sir, we are going down!
I'm the commander of this ship!
Crimson Tide.
God help you if you're wrong.
If I'm wrong, then we're at war. God help us all.
Okay, picture this. It's 1995. You're in a mall. You just crushed a combo at Sparrow. You're holding a Suncoast video bag like it's the briefcase from Pulp Fiction. And inside that bag is a nuclear-grade VHS copy of Crimson Tide, the movie that asks, what if Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington went to war inside a big metal tube full of sweaty dudes and torpedoes? This is the movie where Gene Hackman feeds a dog pizza on a nuclear submarine. This is the movie where Tony Scott basically says, hey, what if the hunt for Red October had more yelling, more rain, more cigarette smoke, and more Hans Zimmer synths that sound like the world's angriest Gregorian chant? You like military thrillers? Boom. Here's a standoff in the control room. You like Denzel being cooler than anyone else on Earth? Boom. Here's him disarming a man with words. You like submarine movies where something goes wrong every 6 minutes and somebody screams, Khan, radio's dead! Like it's a damn horror movie? Buckle up, because this isn't just a thriller. This is a Cold War ghost story soaked in sweat, testosterone, and 1990s moral ambiguity. It's Crimson Tide, baby. And yes, we will be talking about how Tarantino secretly rewrote some of the dialogue. And no, it's not the part you think. Let's dive. All right, pause. Hit the brakes. We got to ask the question that nobody ever asks out loud, but we should. Every single time this movie comes up, is this anyone's favorite Gene Hackman movie? Like, actually? Not top five. Not, my uncle made me watch it because he was in the Navy. I mean, is this your number one, day one, Hackman is God and this is his cathedral type of flick? Because I'm telling you, it's a contender. Hackman is operating at full Hackman. He's not acting. He's commanding. Every line sounds like a threat. Every pause feels like a court-martial. The man quotes Clausewitz mid-panic and then feeds a dog a slice of pizza on a nuclear submarine. He's not just unhinged. He's decorated and unhinged, which is way worse. You're like, okay, he might be wrong, but damn, that's a strong delivery. Jeff, come on. Is it?
Nah. I mean, it's great. It's up there. But Hackman in the conversation? That's hard to beat. That movie is like an anxiety attack with jazz.
Ugh, of course. Of course you picked the quiet, introspective Hackman. You picked paranoid surveillance dad Hackman. That's like picking the black and white art house version of a guy who could end the world while eating greasy triangle food. No, thank you, Steve. What about you? Don't make me regret this.
I mean, I do like when he feeds the dog pizza.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Steve. The pizza dog moment is peak characterization. It says, here's a man who could end humanity, and he's sharing a slice with his terrier like it's a Tuesday. That is cinema. Okay. Now, follow-up question. Is this anyone's favorite Tony Scott movie? Because I'm sorry. We've just walked into holy territory. You are now standing in the Church of Tony, where the stained glass windows are made of flame, sweat, and orange filters. And at the altar, Denzel Washington yelling something righteous while a Hans Zimmer choir vibrates the freaking hall. You got Top Gun, the movie that made aviators and volleyball a constitutional right. You got True Romance, the one where Tony took a Tarantino script and somehow made it gentle. You got Man on Fire, which is just this movie if the submarine was on fire, and also Dakota Fanning.
Don't forget Enemy of the State. That one's practically a sequel to the conversation Hackman's even wearing the same coat.
Yes, thank you. He's literally playing the same character. It's like, I survived Crimson Tide. Now I live in a microwave-lined box in the desert, and I'm best friends with Will Smith. Steve?
I like Domino.
No, you don't. That is a lie. That is a trap. Nobody likes Domino. Not even Domino likes Domino. That movie's like if a Red Bull had a nervous breakdown and made a MySpace biopic. Mickey Rourke looks like a melted action figure. Anyway, back to the point, Crimson Tide might not be the best Tony Scott movie, but it's definitely the most Tony Scott movie. You got the rain, you got the sweat, you got the Bruckheimer energy, you got two dudes staring each other down while the fate of the world hangs in the air, and every extra is nervously pushing buttons and looking wet. This movie looks like everyone involved just came out of a sauna and got into an argument about geopolitics.
And it never really leaves the sub. That's what makes it sing. Pure pressure cooker cinema.
Yes! It's a bottle episode with missiles, and the bottle is sinking.
And the dog is still just hanging out.
The dog is vibing. That dog has seen things. Okay. I know we're here for Crimson Tide, but I need to take a moment to just, sincerely, we got to talk about Tony. Scott.
We have been.
But not enough. Because listen, this dude didn't just direct movies. He made adrenaline art. He made cigarette smoke poetry. He made men cry in slow motion while helicopters roared overhead and everything was either backlit or on fire.
And every frame was orange.
Every single frame. Even the underwater shots are orange. Tony Scott didn't believe in the color blue unless it was the glint of a gun or the glimmer in Denzel's eye.
Or a computer monitor from 1998 with some spy satellite graphics.
Exactly. He was like, what if the entire military-industrial complex looked like a Marlboro commercial directed by Michelangelo? Now, I love Crimson Tide. This movie is tight, clean, and tense as hell. But my favorite Tony Scott movie might still be True Romance.
Oh, of course.
What? That movie is magic. You can feel Tarantino in the dialogue, but Tony directs it with style and warmth and sadness and a Willem Dafoe cocaine-fueled fever dream energy. Nobody else could have pulled that off. Also, Val Kilmer as Ghost Elvis? Come on.
I mean, yeah, it's good. But if I'm picking peak Tony, it's Enemy of the State.
Of course it is. You love a surveillance thriller with 800 quick cuts, 14 satellite feeds, and Will Smith sprinting through a Christmas store yelling about his civil liberties.
It's Tony taking the paranoia of the conversation and cranking it up with modern tech, then slamming it full speed into a Bruckheimer blender. Also, Gene Hackman in a tinfoil hut? Classic.
He literally lives in a tin can with lasers. That movie invented tin foil hat energy.
Mine's Man on Fire. No hesitation.
Yes! Yes! Let's go!
That movie hit me like a truck full of sadness and bullets. Denzel's not just acting, he's ascending. That man was hurting people for love.
That's ones like Tony Scott finally just let go of logic and embraced pure cinematic feeling. It's like every shot is filtered through pain, hope, and saturated film stock.
It's a religious experience. Like, if Crimson Tide is Tony Scott at his most restrained and technical, then Man on Fire is him breaking the glass on all the emergency buttons at once.
It's the only movie where a man kills someone with a butt bomb, and it's somehow poetic.
Denzel puts a bomb in a guy's butt, and you still cry at the ending. That is the power of Tony Scott.
Let's not forget Deja Vu, though. That movie was insane. Time travel surveillance thriller with car chases and emotional trauma? Nobody talks about it, but it's wildly ambitious.
You're right. It's like Tony saw Minority Report, smoked a whole pack of Reds, and said, let's make it louder and weirder.
I always forget how many bangers this man made. You go down the list and it's just hit after hit. Top Gun, Beverly Hills Cop 2, The Last Boy Scout, Unstoppable. That dude went hard until the very end.
And that's what kills me. The guy went out at his peak. Unstoppable is legit. It's about a runaway train, and it rules harder than it has any right to.
Even his lesser movies are still incredibly watchable. Domino, it's a mess. But it's a Tony Scott mess, which means it's still burning at 1,000 degrees.
And don't even get me started on his commercials. That man made a Pepsi ad look like Apocalypse Now.
Tony Scott didn't make content. He made cinematic speedruns of masculinity, fire, sadness, and sunglasses.
Tony, you were the loudest artist we ever had. So yeah, Crimson Tide might not be our number one Tony pick, but it's a masterpiece. It's essential. It's controlled chaos. It's Tony Scott proving that you can make a two-man shouting match in a submarine feel like the fate of the universe is on the line.
It's chess with nukes.
It's 12 Angry Men with depth charges.
It's Tony Scott's quietest movie, and it's still one of the loudest films I've ever seen. Okay, before we get too deep into sonar pings and mutiny tension, I gotta talk about something that's been itching my brain since we started this thing. Because Crimson Tide is tight. It's sharp, it's sweaty, but every once in a while, it says something that makes you go, wait a second. Did this nuclear submarine movie just casually drop a Silver Surfer reference? Which brings me to my favorite little Hollywood trivia bomb. Quentin Tarantino secretly rewrote dialogue for Crimson Tide.
Yep. True story. He was brought in to punch up the script unofficially.
And boy, did he punch. You can feel it. It's like Tarantino walked onto the sub, tossed down a milk crate of comic books, samurai movies, and vintage vinyl, and said, hey, you know what this Cold War thriller needs? Nerd debate energy.
That's why the movie suddenly sounds like a blockbuster parking lot in 1994.
Exactly. You're watching a nuclear standoff. Tense, dramatic. The fate of the world in the balance, and suddenly two guys are arguing about Jack Kirby. It's like if Dr. Strangelove paused so somebody could rank their top five kung fu flicks. And I love it. Let's break it down. So the two most obvious Tarantino-isms are the Silver Surfer argument and the Lipizzaner Stallion monologue.
That's the moment where, you know, for sure, it's him.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about the Silver Surfer scene first. You got two junior guys on the sub, Weps and Cobb, just killing time during a literal potential nuclear launch. And what are they doing? They're debating whether the Silver Surfer was created by Jack Kirby or Stan Lee. In a movie about global nuclear war, in the middle of a crisis, they are fighting about Marvel Comics.
I mean, they're not wrong.
Oh no, they're factually correct. Jack Kirby created the Silver Surfer. Stan Lee wrote him like he was narrating a slam poetry night on a dying star. But that's not the point. The point is, Tarantino slipped this entire nerd bar fight into a military thriller like it was completely normal. Oh, hey, sir, should we prepare for launch? Nah, let's argue about who invented Galactus.
It's such a tonal gear shift, but somehow it doesn't break the movie.
No, that's what's crazy. It actually grounds it. It makes it human. These aren't cardboard soldier men. They're guys, dudes trapped on a giant metal cigar with stress and boredom and deep comic book opinions.
It's the same thing he did in Reservoir Dogs. Guys talking about Madonna while bleeding out.
Yes! And now let's talk about the Lipizzaner Stallions. So there's this moment. Hackman's character, Captain Ramsey, just casually drops a whole monologue about how he loves these fancy Austrian white horses that are trained by the Spanish. He goes, they're born all white, right? Actually, sir, they're born black. And Hackman gets this look like he just found out Christmas was a lie.
He's genuinely stunned.
It's such a Tarantino moment. A little trivia tidbit that means nothing on the surface, but somehow it tells you everything about the character. Because what does that moment say? It says, Hackman is a man who thinks he understands the world. He thinks he knows the horses, but he doesn't. He doesn't know the horses. And if he's wrong about the horses, maybe he's wrong about the nukes.
I don't think that's what it meant.
Shut up, Steve. I'm having a moment. Okay. Tarantino also punched up other bits, little things, lines with flavor, swagger, rhythm. Like the way Denzel says, in the nuclear world, the true enemy is war itself. That's not military lingo. That's a thesis statement disguised as a mic drop. You don't just say that unless you've been monologuing in your head like Jules Winfield.
And even the pacing of some scenes, the way tension builds, then snaps with one line, it feels like Tarantino did a rhythm pass.
Yes, that's his secret weapon. Tarantino understands how people talk when the world's about to end. Not like soldiers, not like philosophers, like movie characters who feel real because they talk like you would in a crisis. Scared, cocky, trying to make sense of chaos with pop culture, memory, and pizza.
It's weird, though. It should have felt out of place, but it doesn't.
Because Tony Scott knew how to blend chaos with clarity, and Tarantino, he gave the movie a soul. A weird, comic book-loving, trivia-dropping, dialogue-flexing soul. And honestly, I think it makes the movie better. I think without the Tarantino stuff, Crimson Tide is still great. But with it, it becomes a little legendary. Because buried under all the torpedoes and cigar smoke is the ghost of a guy who just wanted to make sure you knew who Jack Kirby was before the end of the world. All right, so now that we've opened the hatch on Tarantino secretly rewriting dialogue for Crimson Tide, we gotta dive even deeper, because this wasn't some one-time I owe Bruckheimer a favor kind of thing. Quentin Tarantino has been secretly ghostwriting movies for decades, like some kind of cinephile vigilante, just swooping into other people's movies, dropping monologues about TV pilots and kung fu lore, and then disappearing back into the night like the Zorro of zingers.
He doesn't even take credit half the time. It's just, oh yeah, Quentin punched that up for a weekend in 94. And suddenly the henchman's quoting Lee Van Cleef and playing Nintendo.
It's like finding out your dentist moonlighted sitting in on Abbey Road.
Exactly. Let's go through it. The secret Tarantino script canon. I'm talking about the movies where you're watching and suddenly you go, wait, why is this character casually referencing Yojimbo while holding a shotgun? Let's start with the big one, Crimson Tide. He didn't get credited, but Bruckheimer and Simpson brought him in post-Pulp Fiction to inject some flavor. The script was too dry, too procedural. So Quentin shows up, drops a Silver Surfer monologue and a Lipizzaner Stallion anecdote, and leaves before anyone even notices the smoke.
And it worked. It didn't just humanize the script. It gave it a pop culture heartbeat.
And that's his thing. Tarantino writes like everyone grew up working at a video store and carrying a samurai sword in the trunk of their car.
Which is to say, us.
Correct. All right, next up, The Rock, another Bruckheimer joint. And guess what? He worked on that one too. Another uncredited punch-up. Just like a nuclear John the Baptist. Prepare you the way of the cage.
You can totally hear it. There's this one line where Nicolas Cage goes, I drive a Volvo, a beige one. I like the Beatles, for God's sake. That's pure Tarantino neuroticism. A man mid-breakdown, screaming his entire personality while a missile countdown ticks in the background.
And the insult-laced verbal fencing between Sean Connery and Cage? That is pulp patter at its finest. Like if Raymond Chandler wrote Die Hard.
So does that make The Rock part of the Tarantino cinematic universe?
Yes. In my heart, absolutely. There's a timeline where Stanley Goodspeed goes home and rents True Romance on Laserdisc.
And you know Sean Connery's character, Mason. He 100% knew Mr. Blonde in the 60s.
Oh my God. Yes. You know how I escaped Alcatraz? With Vic Vega. Canon. Locked. In. All right, next up, it's Pat. Yeah, I said it. Quentin Tarantino once claimed he worked on It's Pat, the SNL movie about an androgynous character no one can gender, which might be the most cursed IMDb trivia fact of all time.
Wait, what?
He later denied it. Kind of. But early reports said he was asked to help on a draft.
Imagine Tarantino in 1993, hot off Reservoir Dogs, trying to figure out how to write comedy for a character whose main joke is gender ambiguity. He must have been like, so what if Pat quotes Sonny Chiba and carries a Zippo with Elvis on it?
Did that version exist?
No. Because the movie that came out was 100% Pat, 0% Tarantino. And you can feel the absence. It's like watching a version of Pulp Fiction where no one says anything interesting and then they leave.
Okay. What about Natural Born Killers? That one's weird.
Oh, now that is a whole therapy session. Tarantino wrote the original script. And then Oliver Stone completely rewrote it. Like, cut the brakes, drove into the desert, and hallucinated it into a psychedelic nightmare. QT hates that version, but it still has his fingerprints all over it. The Lovers on the Run template, the hyper-violent media satire, the bad people saying cool things energy. It's like watching Tarantino's evil twin make a fever dream remix of his work.
Wasn't there another one? Like From Dusk Till Dawn?
Yes! But that's less secret and more chaotic brilliance. He wrote it, acted in it, produced it, and then let Robert Rodriguez direct it like it was two movies duct taped together with tequila and holy water.
First half is a heist film. Second half is vampire apocalypse.
It's like someone asked, what if Reservoir Dogs suddenly turned into Evil Dead halfway through? And Tarantino just said, yes. So yeah, Tarantino's secret script legacy? It's messy. It's chaotic. It's beautiful. He's like a script doctor with a katana and a Criterion collection.
He doesn't do rewrites. He does soul injections.
He doesn't punch up. He rewires your DNA.
And I'm grateful for it. Because if Tarantino hadn't slipped into Crimson Tide, we wouldn't have comic books on a sub. Horses as political metaphors, Hackman, Denzel, and a pizza-eating dog operating in the same narrative space as Jack Kirby trivia. So thank you, Quentin. Thank you for showing us that even in the darkest corners of Cold War dread, there's still room for a nerd fight about Galactus.
Adam, how many other hatches are we going to open today? Because so far we've gone from nuclear war to comic books to a vampire strip club to Tarantino possibly ghostwriting its Pat. Like, how deep is this submarine exactly?
As deep as the ocean, Jeff. As deep as Hackman's voice when he says, give me the mission profile. We haven't even opened the who would star in the modern remake hatch. Or the is the dog a metaphor for the American people hatch. Or the top five sweatiest performances in history hatch.
There's definitely a hatch labeled Gandolfini was there the whole time, and I am ready to open it.
Okay, but when we drown in metaphorical depth charges, I'm blaming you.
Jeff, I would rather go down arguing about submarine cinema and pop culture cameos than live in a world where we didn't talk about Tarantino's rejected monologue about Captain Kirk joining the Navy.
That sounds fake, but also real.
It's both. Okay, real quick before we dive into the plot of Crimson Tide, I got to bring something up, something that's been weighing on my soul since Tuesday at 2:17 p.m.
Was it about the movie?
It about the sandwich incident?
It was about the sandwich incident. Let's talk about fridge law. Let's talk about honor in shared spaces. If you are in a confined, high-stress, emotionally volatile environment, like, I don't know, a nuclear submarine or the break room at work, and you see an unmarked sandwich in a Ziploc bag, do you eat it?
No, you absolutely do not.
Only if you're a saboteur or a man who has nothing left to lose.
Exactly. Eating an unclaimed sandwich is a declaration of war. It's a line you cannot uncross. You might as well fire a torpedo at morale.
The second you eat that sandwich, trust evaporates. From that moment forward, everything becomes suspect. The coffee creamer, the Wi-Fi, your superior officer's moral compass.
That's how mutinies start, not with orders, with mayonnaise.
And that's what Crimson Tide is really about. It's the sandwich protocol. Chain of command? Sure. Launch codes? Important. But true leadership begins with respecting the sandwich zone.
This is honestly more thematic than the Navy wanted this movie to be.
Hackman would absolutely eat someone's sandwich without asking.
And defend it. The bag was unmarked, Lieutenant. In a moment of crisis, you don't hesitate.
Meanwhile, Denzel is like, with all due respect, sir, that pastrami belonged to Seaman Rodriguez.
And we're not launching until we determine sandwich ownership beyond reasonable doubt.
Yes, yes, that's the whole movie. Two men, one launch key, and a very tense, slowly warming roast beef panini.
I'm just saying, if there had been a post-it note on the sandwich, no mutiny. World saved. Dog stays happy.
The real hero of Crimson Tide is the label maker.
We need protocols for lunch meat. We need order, because when the fridge goes lawless, so do the missiles.
Lewis, please, take us to break.
This episode of Rewind or Die is brought to you by Ziploc, the official containment unit for unmarked sandwiches, moral ambiguity, and submarine anxiety. Also by the Sandwich Protocol, because when there's no name, there is only chaos. We now return you to Rewind or Die, already submerged in lunch-fueled mutiny.
Thank you, Lewis. The only man we trust to guard the galley fridge and the nuclear launch key.
Double sealed, clearly labeled, chain of mayonnaise preserved.
Let's talk Crimson Tide. Because when you strip away the sonar, the politics, the procedural tension, you know what you're left with?
One boat, two men, and zero sandwiches. Okay, before we go full plot breakdown and start measuring torpedo tension in sweat droplets per second, can we just take one moment to appreciate the fact that this is a movie where Gene Hackman brought his dog onto a nuclear submarine?
Like, that's real. That's canon. The U.S. Navy may have said no thanks to supporting this movie, but Gene Hackman said yes to Pizza Dog.
There is a scene where a man in uniform feeds a slice of pepperoni to a terrier while discussing launch authorization.
And it's played completely straight. No one blinks. It's just, sir, Russian sub on sonar. Deploy battle stations. Also, here's a treat for snaps.
What's wild is that the dog adds gravitas. You're like, this man is prepared to end the world, but also knows how to care for something small and fluffy.
Honestly, that dog might be the most emotionally stable character on the entire boat.
Absolutely. Snaps never panics. Snaps never betrays anyone. Snaps never argues about Jack Kirby.
If they had put Snaps in charge, the launch keys would have never turned.
You just hear a single bark every time someone tried to override the chain of command.
Okay. Now that we've emotionally recentered ourselves through military dog meditation, let's break open this movie like a depth charge.
Crimson Tide, plot time, let's dive.
All right, let's dive in, because Crimson Tide wastes no time. We open on a big dramatic title card that might as well say, "Hey, do you like stress?"
It literally starts with global nuclear crisis energy. Russian ultranationalists take control of a missile base, and everyone's like, "Welp, time to launch the submarine."
I like how the movie opens like a Tom Clancy panic attack and then immediately drops us into Gene Hackman's face. Like, "Hello, I am your dad now."
Yes! Hackman shows up looking like a man who drinks black coffee with a side of gunpowder. And he's got a dog, not like a support animal, like a co-commander. That dog is included in briefings. That dog knows the launch codes.
He brings the dog on the sub. Like, "Sir, you're commanding nuclear warheads and also trying to remember if Rex needs heartworm meds?"
No one questions it. Everyone's just like, "Ah, yes, the Admiral brought his pizza-eating terrier. Business as usual."
The intensity of Hackman cannot be overstated. The second he shows up, the movie goes from tense to, "Sir, I think the screen is smoking." You could grill a steak on that man's forehead.
And then we meet Denzel, Lieutenant Commander Hunter. He's calm, collected, and definitely not ready for Hackman's daily chaos routine. He's thoughtful, analytical. He's like, "Let's consider the facts before we nuke someone." Meanwhile, Hackman is already halfway through the launch checklist and offering the dog a slice of pepperoni.
Denzel is like, "Sir, maybe we should wait for intel." And Hackman's like, "Intel? I'll get intel from the sound of this man's sweating."
The power dynamic is set immediately. Hackman's like your grandpa who drives with 2 feet. Denzel's the guy politely removing the keys.
It's old school versus new school. Ramsey's all gut instinct and Cold War muscle memory. Hunter's the Harvard-educated guy who reads Clausewitz for fun and doesn't yell at breakfast.
And this is why this movie rules. From the jump, you've got two men on the same side of a nuclear submarine who could not be more different. One's like, fire the missiles. The other's like, let's wait 15 seconds so we don't accidentally kill 300 million people.
It's a buddy comedy where the punchline is World War III.
You've got Denzel walking around all calm and cerebral, and Hackman just vibrating with rage like he's been chewing on batteries since NAMM.
Also, let's talk about the way this sub looks. Tony Scott has never met a smoke machine he didn't like. Every hallway looks like a cigarette ad in hell.
There's no natural light anywhere. It's just steel, sweat, and existential dread. And the whole time, Hans Zimmer is in the background like, Bwahm! Church chant, drum of war. Bwahm again.
Zimmer's score sounds like a monastery, caught on fire and decided to roll with it.
And I love it. It tells you right away, this isn't just a submarine movie. It's a moral Thunderdome with hull plating.
So in summary, Hackman, nuclear dad with anger issues and a dog. Denzel, philosopher king with infinite restraint. The dog, probable war criminal. The sub, sweat sauna filled with missile tubes.
Let's move on to the crew, because this boat is packed with guys who all look like they smoke cigars underwater. All right, so now we're on the sub. The tone is grim. The lighting is non-existent. Everyone is sweating through their uniforms. Time to meet the boys.
And by boys, we mean a who's who of 90s character actors and future movie legends all crammed into a metal tube of testosterone and mild dehydration.
Every single guy on this sub looks like he either just passed SEAL training or just woke up hungover in a Chili's parking lot.
Okay, so first up, we got Viggo. Yes, Aragorn Viggo, but here, he's weapons officer Viggo Mortensen, the guy stuck between his loyalty to Hackman and his deep, yearning respect for Denzel's sense of ethics and perfect posture.
He's quiet. He's intense. He looks like he's constantly on the verge of either crying or launching a missile. And sometimes, both.
He spends half the movie staring into middle distance like he's pondering the morality of war, but also doing math in his head.
He's playing the role of guy you'd trust with the codes, but you know he writes poetry.
Then we've got Steve Zahn, the most unexpected face on a nuclear submarine. He's playing, I think, guy who is definitely going to get yelled at by Hackman before lunch.
He's the junior officer who has no idea what movie he's in. Like, everyone else is in a political thriller, and Zahn's like, hey guys, you ever think about what the Hulk would be like in real life?
Which brings us to the Silver Surfer debate. Aye, baby. We made it.
The Tarantino scene.
So we're on a submarine. Tensions are high. There are nukes on board. And what are two sailors doing?
They are fully engaged in a heated nerd fight over whether Jack Kirby or Stan Lee created the Silver Surfer.
And it is glorious. It's not just a throwaway bit. It's a whole argument. They go in. And the thing is, they're right. Jack Kirby did create the Silver Surfer. Stan Lee just made him extra sad and poetic.
This scene is doing so much. Like, yes, it's obviously Tarantino, but also it humanizes these guys. They're not soldier bots. They're bored dudes with opinions. One of them probably owns a Galactus-themed Zippo.
It's like watching Reservoir Dogs Submarine Edition. I was honestly waiting for Hackman to walk in and scream, I don't give a damn who created him. We're on DEFCON 2.
It's also perfect pacing. Right when things are getting heavy, the movie slips in a weird, brilliant tangent and reminds you, these people are real. Real nerds. Real arguments. Real stakes.
Okay, now let's talk about the fire. There's a fire in the galley. Because of course there is. Everything in this movie is on the verge of either igniting or exploding.
Fire breaks out. Panic mode. People are running, shouting, steam everywhere. It looks like a Metallica concert happening inside a waffle iron.
Hackman's watching it from the command deck like a man waiting to see who disappoints him the most.
And Denzel, smooth as hell, steps in and takes total control. He's calm. He's efficient. He's like, let's not die today, gentlemen. Meanwhile, Hackman's up, top going. That's not how I do it, but I respect it, I guess.
This is the moment where you see the crew's trust shifting. Hunter's not just smart, he's capable. He's cool under pressure. He's the guy you want handling your missile launch or your brunch reservation.
It's subtle, but you can feel the loyalty, realignment beginning. Some of these guys are starting to look at Hunter like, okay, maybe he knows what he's doing. Also, he doesn't scream at clouds.
So now we've got lines being drawn. The crew isn't just a crew anymore. They're a bunch of guys picking sides in a showdown between Hackman the Hammer and Denzel the Philosopher General.
Which means it's only a matter of time before someone says, sir, I don't think we should launch those missiles just yet.
Translation, this submarine's about to get real awkward.
All right, people, strap in, because this is where Crimson Tide kicks it into high gear. Up until now, we've been simmering. This is the moment where someone yells, boil it.
The plot officially goes DEFCON drama. There's unrest in Russia. Ultra-nationalists have control of the missiles. Washington, D.C. is freaking out. And our boys on the USS Alabama get a message.
Not just any message. The EAM emergency action message. The one that basically says, hey fellas, time to nuke someone.
And just like that, the whole energy of the movie shifts. You feel the silence when that order comes in. It's like, oh, we might actually do this. We might launch.
So Captain Hackman's like, well, let's lock in. Get the launch codes. Turn both keys. Maybe let the dog press a button too.
The dog's like, I've trained for this.
Meanwhile, Denzel is sitting there going, should we maybe take a breath? Check for updates? Maybe not in civilization just yet?
And that's the setup, because just as they start prepping for launch, they get a second message.
Dun, dun, dun!
And then the radio goes out mid-message.
Let's go! That is chef's kiss tension. They've got half a message. Half! Not a typo, not a clarification, just abort mission, if static.
Which brings us to the core philosophical question of the entire film. Do you launch the missiles based on the first message, or do you wait to confirm the second?
And Hackman, of course, is like, we have our orders. We follow protocol. Launch the missiles.
And Denzel is like, sir, what if the second message was a cancellation?
This is where the movie lives. This moment. Two men, same crew, same sub, but completely different interpretations of what duty means.
Yes! Hackman's like, obey the chain of command. Don't question the system. And Denzel's like, sir, the system might be telling us to blow up the wrong country.
The tension is palpable. Like, you could cut the air with a butter knife and it would start sweating too.
The second that radio breaks, everyone on the sub gets a little more panicked. Suddenly, the lines start forming. You got the launch now, guys. And the maybe let's not nuke people, guys.
And Hackman, he's got that I've been waiting 30 years for this moment energy. He's practically itching to turn that key.
It's like the man's been dreaming of a nuclear launch since his third birthday party. You just know he's the kind of guy who calls nukes freedom sticks.
Meanwhile, Denzel's over here trying to save the world, and everyone's like, wow, what a buzzkill.
So now we're at the tipping point. The radio's down. The missiles are prepped. Tensions are peaking. Hackman is storming around like a rage-powered lunchbox, and Denzel's tightening his tie like he's about to professionally ruin someone's day.
And this isn't even the mutiny yet. This is just the foreplay.
That's the terrifying part. This is still the calm part.
So to sum up, the world is teetering, the crew is divided, the radio is toast. And somewhere, Viggo Mortensen is in a corner of the ship quietly debating if loyalty is worth annihilation.
Welcome to the Submarine Philosophy Olympics.
Winner gets to not start a war.
Coming up next, the mutiny. And trust me, it's about to get uncomfortable, unhinged, and underwater. Okay, this is it. This is the moment Crimson Tide becomes less of a movie and more of a one-act play performed inside a torpedo.
Everything that's been bubbling under the surface, the tension, the mistrust, the philosophical split, it boils over. Right here, right now, underwater.
And it's not even a big action scene. It's a chain of command dispute with more stakes than the entire MCU.
Yes! Because now the radio is down. They've got half a launch order. And Hackman is standing there like, well, that's good enough for me. Time to unleash the apocalypse.
And Denzel finally says, nah, not on my watch.
And then he does it. He pulls the nuclear Uno reverse card. Denzel relieves Hackman of command on his own submarine.
Which is, in military terms, the biggest move imaginable.
This is like kicking your dad out of his own barbecue halfway through grilling. You just don't do it unless someone's about to light the propane tank.
And the moment it happens, you can feel the entire ship split in half. Not physically, emotionally.
You've got Team Ramsey, guys who believe in orders, experience, and doing what they're told. And Team Hunter, guys who believe in thinking before launching planet-melting missiles.
And Viggo Mortensen is standing right in the middle, like, cool, 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 cool. Guess I'll just carry the world's biggest moral dilemma on my back like a sad Viking.
The stress on Viggo's face is like he just realized both his parents showed up to the school play and are now fighting in the parking lot.
You can feel him dying inside. He's loyal to Ramsey, Hackman, because they go way back. But he respects Hunter, Denzel, because the man is right. And you just know Viggo's brain is like, this is how I end up launching a nuke by accident and crying in the shower.
So Hunter's now acting commander. He puts Ramsey under arrest, and Ramsey does not take it well.
The man goes full disrespected warlord. He's giving tight-lipped fury. He's pacing like a lion in church shoes. You can see the I'm going to retake this sub by sheer force of will building behind his eyeballs.
He basically spends the next 20 minutes plotting an HR-violating coup.
And here's where Gandolfini comes in hot.
Oh, yes. Let's talk about James freaking Gandolfini. He's lurking in the background like a very sweaty henchman who just learned the word insubordination.
He's fully Team Ramsey. And by team, I mean I will personally sabotage communications, pretend it was an accident, and hope no one notices I just committed a felony.
Which he does. They sabotage the radio. Literally cut the cables. Because if they can't receive a cancellation message, they can still launch.
It is full-on coup behavior. Like, oops, the radio broke again. Weird. Haha. Anyway, let's end the world now.
The quietest mutiny in cinematic history. Just a few sweaty dudes tiptoeing around the apocalypse.
Meanwhile, Hunter is holding it together with the patience of a saint and the stare of a man who has read every military protocol twice.
There's a standoff, a counter-standoff, a counter-counter-authorization confirmation. It's like chess with war crimes.
And it all builds to the hallway. You know the one. Hunter versus Ramsey. Both men staring each other down like philosophical raptors.
Hackman's like, yeah, this is my sub. And Denzel's like, ah, not today, sir. And if you don't feel your soul rattle during that scene, you might be a robot.
It's mutiny without a single punch thrown, just words and protocol and extreme eye contact.
And somehow that makes it scarier, because this isn't about violence. It's about who gets to decide the future of the human race inside a metal cylinder with no escape.
So now we've got Ramsey, locked in his quarters. Hunter, trying to keep the ship from falling apart. The crew, divided and terrified. The radio, still broken. And the missiles, still. Ready. To launch.
It's a pressure cooker inside a pressure cooker inside a nuclear warhead.
And the dog is just like, I didn't ask for this.
The clock is ticking. The cables are cut. And there's still one more decision left to make. Okay, this is it. This is the final boss fight, the ticking clock moment, the part where everything is about to go full apocalypse. And it all happens inside a room with blinking lights and one guy breathing heavily into a headset.
This is the launch sequence. Hackman regains control of the sub because Gandolfini and the coup crew pull off a little behind-the-scenes insurrection. They reclaim the Khan, and Ramsay is back in the big chair like, okay, let's try that whole ending civilization thing again, shall we?
He's just marching down the hallway like a man late to a funeral he caused.
Denzel is locked up. He's in submarine jail. And let me tell you something. Submarine jail is just a hallway with two angry guys standing nearby. It's not secure. It's just vibes.
And Hackman goes full war mode. He re-engages the launch protocol. People are turning keys. Missile doors are opening. Zimmer's score is like, wham! Chance! And bongos of fate. Every crew member is dripping with fear and condensation.
It's like the world's worst escape room. And the only way out is not nuking anyone.
So now we're in it. The countdown has started. They are literally seconds away from launching a full spread of nuclear missiles. And I'm sitting there on my couch like, don't you dare.
And just when it seems like there's no stopping it, just when you think, wow, this is how the movie ends? The radio comes back online.
Yeah, yeah. The message gets through.
And what does it say? Abort launch, the new order, says do not fire. Do you understand what we just avoided? That dog almost became the last president of the United States.
It all hinges on seconds, like literal seconds. They abort the launch at the last possible moment. The key turns are reversed. The missile doors close. And the whole sub just sits there like, well, that was close. Who wants lunch?
It's the most stressful moment in movie history where nothing actually explodes. That's cinema.
And this is the brilliance of Crimson Tide. You think the climax is going to be boom, missile launch, explosions, right? No, it's two men staring each other down while holding keys that could end humanity.
And Denzel's still locked up during this. He gets out after Hackman realizes, oh, turns out maybe this guy who told me not to nuke a country on a hunch was right.
The look Hackman gives when he reads the message. It's not even, oh no, I was wrong. It's, damn, I almost did it. He doesn't show regret. He shows disappointment that he didn't get to follow through.
It's the submarine version of a guy trying to return a firework that already went off.
So the launch is aborted, the crisis is averted. Nobody dies. The dog goes back to napping in the corner like he didn't just witness the greatest moral conflict since Sophie's Choice.
Everyone is shaken. Like, existentially shaken. But technically, mission complete. The crew survived. The nukes stayed put. And Hackman now has to deal with the fact that Denzel Washington intellectually judo flipped him.
You know he hates it. He's like, I still outrank you. But also, maybe I should resign and let you take the wheel, because clearly, you are better than me at everything, including talking to humans.
And now we head into fallout mode, the calm after the storm, the you're not fired, but we'll talk about this later phase.
Okay, so there's still fallout from all of this. We didn't nuke anyone. The dog survived. The world still exists. We are out of the blast radius. But now comes the part that hurts in a different way. The debrief, the fallout, the awkward office meeting where everyone pretends not to remember that one time they almost launched a global extinction event.
We cut to the Navy tribunal. Some suits in a wood-paneled room are reviewing everything that happened on the sub. And I do mean everything.
Imagine being the guy who has to say, so then the captain attempted to retake the Khan while the dog was eating pepperoni, and the XO was detained in hallway jail.
And listen, this courtroom scene is so polite. It's tense, but quiet. No yelling, no, you can't handle the truth. Just icy professional contempt.
It's the Navy way of saying, we are furious, but we're going to deal with it through administrative recommendations and icy glances.
Now, what's fascinating here is nobody gets thrown under the bus. Not officially, not publicly.
They basically say, both men acted with integrity and under extreme stress and with slightly different interpretations of protocol.
Which is insane. That's HR speak for one of these dudes almost nuked Russia out of pure stubbornness, but it's fine.
And yet, it works. The moral ambiguity of this ending is so good. There's no hero shot. No sweeping music cue saying, this guy won. It's just two men, still standing, both changed, both kind of broken.
And then we get the final scene.
Yes.
Ramsey is retiring. He's handing over the keys. And just before he leaves, he gives Hunter, Denzel, this tiny sliver of respect.
He says something like, we were both right, but I was more right until you were more right.
Which is the most Hackman way to apologize. It's not, I'm sorry. It's, I acknowledge your perspective within a hierarchy of temporary correctness.
And Denzel doesn't gloat, doesn't smug smile. He just accepts it, because that's who he is. He doesn't need a victory lap. He just needed the world not to burn.
And the dog still chilling, like none of this happened.
Honestly, I think the dog is a metaphor for America, dragged into a nuclear standoff, given no choice. Still here, still hungry, still confused.
So that's it. That's Crimson Tide. No explosions, no high body count, just decisions. Tension, sweat. And two god-tier actors locking horns in the world's most stressful underwater philosophy class.
It's chess with torpedoes, it's therapy with sonar, it's morality under 20,000 tons of pressure.
It is one of the greatest military thrillers ever made. And I will scream that into the periscope of history until my lungs give out.
So the final verdict, Crimson Tide, certified Hall of Fame. No notes. Well, one note. More dog backstory.
Dog prequel when?
Next time on Rewind or Die. Pizza Dog, the Pentagon years. When it comes to Rewind or Die, there's no such thing as a routine mission. Before we go any further, can I just say, if that dog had been in Reservoir Dogs, it would have been a better movie.
You've said for years Reservoir Dogs would have been better with actual dogs.
And I stand by it. Snaps wouldn't have tortured the cop. He would have de-escalated, used non-lethal nips.
Honestly, I'd watch a full QT Kennel verse, Mr. Bark, Mr. Woof. Are you going to launch that missile? No, but I did sniff it.
Lewis, please get us out of this.
This episode of Rewind or Die is brought to you by Battle Stations, the official Navy workout VHS. Get shredded at sea with 42 minutes of lunges, push-ups, and passive-aggressive barking from your commanding officer. Now featuring bonus segments like crate drills with Snaps and Cold War Core with Commander Hackman. And by Torpede No, the official submarine air freshener. Eliminate the stench of sweat, ego, and unprocessed trauma with our new deep sea lavender blend. Because if you're going to disobey orders, you should at least smell like a summer breeze.
Thank you, Lewis, and thank you, Torpede No, because nothing ruins a tense mutiny like musty control room funk.
There's only so much air to cycle, Adam, and a lot of unresolved man feelings trapped in those ducts.
I trust Snaps more than I trust whoever's in charge of ventilation.
All right, back to Crimson Tide. Let's open some more hatches. You guys, I want to try something new.
God help us.
Let's open the forbidden hatch.
Alternate ending theater. That's right. This is the segment where we say, hey, what if the studio had notes? What if test audiences were confused? What if we got weird?
Because nothing says respectful tribute to military protocol like massively rewriting the ending.
Let's begin. One, the dog takes command. So radio's down, crew's divided. Ramsey and Hunter are locked in a standoff. Suddenly, the dog stands up, just walks into the control room. Everyone freezes.
The dog puts one paw on the launch key and the other paw on the radio headset.
Everyone stares. He barks. One bark equals abort. Two barks equals fire.
He barks once. Launch sequence aborted.
Good boy.
The Pentagon immediately promotes him to admiral. His little uniform has four stars and a tiny bone pin.
He retires on a boat in Key West and writes a memoir.
Title, Tales of Command. Two. Nukes launch anyway, but they're blanks. Hunter fails. Ramsey launches the nukes, but plot twist. The missiles were decommissioned training dummies.
The whole thing was a test to see who would follow orders and who would ask questions.
Ramsey fails the test. Hunter passes. The Navy's like, congratulations. You've been promoted to president.
Ramsey gets sent to a teaching post at Submarine Community College. The dog, still in charge.
3. Time travel sub. Okay, what if? Stick with me here. The sub passes through a sonar anomaly and ends up in World War II.
No, absolutely not.
But now Hackman's yelling at Nazis, and Denzel's giving tactical speeches to Eisenhower, and the dog's wearing goggles.
They change history by introducing jazz fusion 40 years early.
You've weaponized chaos.
4. Hackman goes full villain. Final scene. Ramsey reads the abort order. He nods. Then rips it up and launches anyway. The final shot is just him, cigar in mouth, saying, "Sometimes you gotta roll the dice."
Cut to black. Zimmer goes full demon choir. Everyone in the theater screams.
Oscar nomination, best use of existential dread in a military context.
5. Denzel gets a spinoff.
Hunter retires, only to be recruited by the CIA.
Oh my God, yes, there we go.
Crimson Tide. 2. Tactical Denzel.
He's solving submarine crimes on land. He's shutting down rogue admirals from a stealth submarine. He's training the dog in jiu-jitsu.
Tagline. This time, he's not underwater. He's over it.
6. The whole thing was a video game.
I am shocked at the number of notes you had for this.
Final scene. Camera pulls back. It's two kids in an arcade playing Sub Commander 95.
Like some kind of off-brand Inception.
Whoa, you almost launched the nukes. Yeah, but I let the dog finish the level.
Cut to Denzel and Hackman as pixelated avatars giving a thumbs up. Credits roll over a MIDI version of Hans Zimmer's theme.
Best ending ever.
And that, friends, concludes this round of Alternate Ending Theater, a new proud tradition where no narrative is safe, no submarine too stable, and no dog left behind.
Next time, we rewrite the ending of Armageddon so Steve Buscemi becomes King of the Moon.
He's already writing the script.
All right, final thoughts before we surface?
Crimson Tide is a classic. Tony Scott, Denzel, Hackman still holds up, still hits hard.
No CGI aliens, no slow-motion helicopters, just men yelling in tight spaces.
As God intended. Remember, in this, only one voice matters, the dogs. All right, folks. Grab your periscopes, button your collars, and prepare to sweat, because it's time for another Behind the Scenes Theater. And today, we are going deep. Deeper than a torpedo tube during DEFCON 1. We're talking the true story of how Crimson Tide got made, and how it nearly sank before it ever surfaced.
You think the drama was just on the sub? You think the tension stopped with Hackman and Denzel? Oh, no. Behind the scenes, this movie was one coffee away from a full-scale studio mutiny.
There was no plan B. Just Tony Scott, a heat lamp, a broken radio, and some dudes with very strong opinions about chain of command.
So Tony Scott, riding high from Top Gun, right? He goes back to the Navy like, "Hey guys, let's do another patriotic action masterpiece. This time, underwater." And the Navy takes one look at the script and goes, "Excuse us, did you say mutiny?"
Yep. They shut the hatch. Said no support, no access, no endorsement. They were like, "We don't do mutiny. That's not our vibe."
And to be fair, half the sub wants to launch nukes. The other half says maybe don't is not the recruiting tool they were looking for.
So what does Tony Scott do? He guerrilla films this thing. He literally stalks the actual USS Alabama with helicopters and speedboats, just to get exterior shots of it diving.
This man went full cinematic pirate, filming unauthorized sub-footage like he was trying to steal national secrets for Bruckheimer.
And when he needed a carrier to shoot on, he went to the French. The French Navy was like, "Sure, you want a nuclear aircraft carrier? Bon voyage, mon frère."
So if you're watching Crimson Tide and thinking, "Why does this feel like it's hiding from the U.S. military?" It is.
Let's talk about the performances. Gene Hackman, Denzel Washington, two men, one sub, zero patience.
Hackman is old school intensity, one take, no nonsense. He walks onto the set like he's already angry at the editor.
Denzel, methodical, focused, crafted. He's like, "Let me find the emotional center of this moment."
L,
and these two clashed, not in a fist fight way, not in a screaming match, but in a laser eye contact, passive aggressive, high tension standoff that matched the movie.
And Tony Scott loved it. He was like, yes, yes, roll the cameras. Don't fix it. Let them stew.
Every scene feels like they're one heartbeat away from throwing down. And somehow, it made the movie better. And then, Quentin Tarantino. Oh, yes, he's unlisted, uninvited, but 1,000% in the script.
Now, this is what the third or fourth time in this episode we've talked about it, but it has such a footprint on the movie, it is still worth mentioning. So Jerry Bruckheimer brings him in to punch up the dialogue.
And you can tell
the Silver Surfer argument, totally Tarantino. The Lipizzaner horse monologue, Tarantino. All those moments where you're like, wait, am I watching a nuclear thriller or a pop culture philosophy podcast? Tarantino.
And Denzel was like, yeah, no. They reportedly argued over the new dialogue.
But eventually, they worked it out. Because this movie needed that weird energy. Without those moments, it's just gray metal, cigars, and stress.
With them, it's Shakespeare in a torpedo tube.
So, the submarine set, built from scratch, on gimbals, so it could rock and sway like a real sub.
Actors had to walk, act, sweat, and balance like they were in Cirque du Soleil, Naval Edition.
The lighting? So realistic, which means dim, flickering, and full of atmospheric steam.
Also, it was hot. The set was boiling. You didn't need a makeup department. You needed a hydration tent and an ice bath.
Every bead of sweat on screen? That's method sweating. Authentic. Raw. Possibly OSHA violating.
Let's talk about the score. Hans Zimmer shows up like, I have composed your doom.
It's not just music. It's a thunderous Gregorian panic attack. Every note feels like it's being chanted by monks who know too much. Okay, real quick. Do you guys remember that weird moment in 1994 when Gregorian monks had a full-blown pop culture phase? Like actual charting albums.
What?
There was a solid six-month stretch where every movie trailer, vitamin commercial, and candle store had this deep, breathy monk chanting, playing in the background like we were all about to be spiritually cleansed via CD-ROM. And somehow, that exact vibe is encapsulated in this movie's score. Hans Zimmer basically said, what if the church choir at the end of the world was really into nuclear protocol? It's not just music. It's a bass-loaded, dread-soaked, monastic sound detonation. It sounds like 500 men in robes chanting your moral collapse into the void.
You know what's wild? That Gregorian monk music phase wasn't just a blip. It was everywhere. You'd walk into a Walden Books in 1994, and they'd be playing some ancient Latin chant over trance beats, like you were supposed to achieve spiritual enlightenment between the Goosebumps display and a calendar of wolves. And it wasn't just stores, movie trailers, perfume ads, documentary soundtracks, late-night CD compilations. All of it sounded like a haunted abbey discovered techno. And somehow, Hans Zimmer looked at that moment in time and said, yes, this, but with nuclear tension and Denzel. So now we've got a score where every 5 minutes there's this tsunami of low-frequency chanting that feels like a monastery is about to declare war. You don't even hear it coming. You just feel your ribs tighten. And then, bwaaam. That's not a sound cue. That's God slamming a bulkhead and whispering, you are not ready. That bwaaam sound, invented right here. This movie walked so Inception could stress out.
And the Navy hymn, Eternal Father, Strong to Save, gives the whole thing a ghostly, haunting quality, like patriotism haunted by regret.
Zimmer won a Grammy for this. Not an Oscar, a Grammy. For a score that sounds like Beethoven joined a cult inside a pressure cooker.
The movie's central dilemma, do we launch nukes without full intel, wasn't just a dramatic conceit. It's based on a real Cold War event. Cuban Missile Crisis. A Soviet submarine actually got cut off from command. The captain wanted to launch. His second in command said no. And because of that one disagreement, We are still here.
So when people say this movie's far-fetched, nah, man, it's documentary adjacent. So what did we learn?
The Navy was nervous. Hackman and Denzel were tense. Tony Scott filmed like a fugitive. Zimmer went full cathedral panic attack. And somehow, through it all, we got a masterpiece. Crimson Tide isn't just a thriller. It's a war of philosophies, a battle of acting titans, and the sweatiest movie ever made that doesn't take place in a jungle.
If stress were a genre, this movie invented it.
And for that, we salute it, even if the Navy won't. I mean, they have to begrudgingly love it now, right?
All right. Box office time. So Crimson Tide opened on May 12th, 1995, and it immediately took the number one spot. $18.6 million opening weekend. In 1995 dollars? That's practically equal to $1 billion and a Pepsi tie-in now. That's like a stadium full of Blockbuster employees handing you cash.
That's so much VHS.
That's rollerblade money.
And listen to what it beat out. It came in ahead of French Kiss, Friday While You Were Sleeping, and Village of the Damned. And that same month, you've got Die Hard with a Vengeance rolling in with Jeremy Irons' Brain Puzzles and New York PTSD. You've got Braveheart showing up to scream about freedom. You've got Congo and Batman Forever waiting in the wings to ruin your childhood and your wallet.
I'm sorry, Congo. We let Crimson Tide and Congo share airspace.
I think 1995 was a test from the universe.
By the end of its run, Crimson Tide made $91.4 million domestic, over $157 million worldwide. That's hit territory. That's Hackman gets a new vacation house with a dog elevator, money.
Honestly, good. That dog earned it.
Snaps carried emotional continuity through 80 minutes of moral crisis.
And this movie opened 1 week before Die Hard with a Vengeance, which made $100 million more. And Crimson Tide still held on, like a torpedo of relevance blasting through box office smoke.
It didn't care about summer blockbusters. It didn't care about cartoon ghosts or Scottish revolutionaries. It just sat there in its steel tube, sweating and shouting about launch codes.
Like a dad at a pool party who can't figure out a Bluetooth speaker.
You had Batman Forever. You had Apollo 13. You had Pocahontas, Dangerous Minds, Waterworld, Babe. 1995 was a cinematic riot.
It's too many movies.
It's like every script got greenlit at once, and they all showed up to fight.
Crimson Tide held its ground in a year where Talking Pigs, Moon Missions, and Val Kilmer as Neon Dracula were all considered normal.
And that's why we respect it, because in the middle of all that madness, it just gave us two men, one sub and zero chill, and a dog.
And monks.
So many monks.
Okay, look, I know there wasn't any official Crimson Tide fast food tie-in merch.
I want there to be so bad.
There was no Burger King's Submarine Periscope Cup. There was no Saturday morning cartoon where Denzel and Hackman solve mysteries with the dog and teach kids about diplomacy. But what if there was?
Steve. Yes, you're opening a portal I've been waiting to walk through my whole life.
Oh, no.
Picture it. Crimson Tide, the animated series. Every episode ends with a life lesson. Remember, kids, always verify your launch codes and never mutiny without a buddy.
Theme song by Mark Mothersbaugh. Opening credits are just missiles rising dramatically while the dog skateboards through the control room with sunglasses on.
Denzel's cartoon character would wear the same uniform, but with radical shoulder pads and holographic medals. Hackman's cartoon version has laser eyebrows.
And the dog talks, voiced by David Spade.
Yes! He's like, hey, Captain, maybe don't start a global war today, huh? I got a date with a poodle.
They fight weekly villains like Doctor, Deep State, and the Radio Scrambler.
And the fast food tie-ins? McDonald's Underwater Commander Meal. Comes with a mini sonar console that makes three random noises. Beep, bark. And Hackman yelling, weapons control!
Burger King has submarine launching straws. You blow into them and they fire little plastic nukes at your sister.
Taco Bell gives you a cardboard periscope that fogs up when you breathe on it because it's authentic.
And the toy line? Absolute fire. You get Action Pose Ramsey with strategic finger-pointing grip. Philosopher Hunter with a pull string that says, let's wait for the full message.
There's a Deluxe Dog Command Center playset. Comes with pizza, a headset, and his own nuke key.
Every figure can come with a little button that makes them sweat.
No, you dip them in water, and they get progressively shinier. It's Realistic Submarine Tension Technology trademark.
Crimson Tide, the game for Sega Genesis. It's a side-scrolling ethical debate simulator.
And at the end of every cartoon episode, you get a moral. The screen freezes on Denzel's cartoon face, and he goes, just because you outrank someone doesn't mean you're right. Then the dog skateboards across the screen with a slice of pizza in his mouth.
Hoo-ha.
You've all lost your minds, but honestly, I'd watch that.
I'd buy the whole toy line.
Coming soon to VHS. Crimson Tide Deep Sea Diplomacy, rated Y7 for extreme naval tension and brief existential crises.
Who remembers Y7, Steve?
Hang on, I'll be right back.
Okay, real quick. Before we wrap this up, I got to do this. Because people always ask me, Adam, what are your top submarine movies of all time? And I say, I got three. That's all I need. That's the full fleet. The holy trinity of hull stress and sonar pings. Number one, Crimson Tide. Of course. The gold standard. The submarine movie to end all submarine movies. It's sweaty. It's philosophical. It's got Denzel delivering existential threats with a clipboard. And Hackman. Hackman's up in the control room like he invented yelling. You could bottle the tension in this movie and use it to power a second sub. And let's not forget the dog eats pizza while two grown men almost destroy Russia. That's cinema. Number two, The Hunt for Red October. Yes, a.k.a. dad movie Nirvana. Sean Connery is a Russian sub-captain with a Scottish accent that no one questions. Everything about this movie feels like it smells like aftershave and classified documents. The music, majestic. The politics, Cold War-tastic. And Alec Baldwin as Jack Ryan. This is before he became a professional SNL impression. He's just nervous and smart and very 90s divorced energy. And then, number three. Yes, I'm serious. Down. Periscope.
Oh, God.
Don't you dare. Down. Periscope is the comedy gem of the underwater genre. It's Kelsey Grammer as a rogue submarine captain with a tattooed dolphin on his chest and a crew made entirely of weirdos, screw-ups, and future character actors. This movie is what would happen if the Navy let community theater run a nuclear submarine, and I love it. You've got Rob Schneider losing his mind, Lauren Holly doing the I'm the only woman on this sub routine with actual dignity somehow. And Harry Dean Stanton as a mechanic who definitely ate lead paint as a child. It's stupid. It's silly. It has a whale decoy scene. And it is a comfort movie of the highest order. So yeah, Crimson Tide, Hunt for Red October, Down Periscope. Those are the ones. If I'm ever trapped in a sub and I only get three VHS tapes to keep me sane while the reactor hums in the background, those are the tapes. And if you disagree, then we are no longer operating on the same sonar frequency, my friend. All right, I think we've officially gone fully adrift.
We are off the map, sailing through the Mariana Trench of metaphor with zero contact with command.
We left the sub, we entered our feelings, and now we're just floating in an emotional decompression chamber made of sweat and unresolved dad issues.
Okay, let's pull up. Let's get back on track. Let's do some actual movie analysis, because Crimson Tide, this wasn't just a good movie. It did numbers.
Wait, hang on. Why are we circling back to the box office? Did we forget it? Did it launch late? Are we just rechecking the sonar on 1995? Because this feels like you guys are trying to quietly sneak in a financial victory lap and hoping I don't notice.
No, Steve. We're circling back because the box office numbers are a sonar ping of public trust. They tell us who showed up, who said, yes, I want to see Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington sweat yell at each other in a steel tube. This is about context. This is about cultural readiness. This is about knowing who we were through receipts.
So, yes, victory lap.
Obviously.
Yeah, this thing was a hit. It made $91 million domestically, $157 million worldwide on a $53 million budget in 1995 money, which is like $1 billion in sweaty submarine conversion math.
And it wasn't some summer tentpole either. It came out in May, right before Batman Forever and Die Hard, with a vengeance, dropped like box office nukes.
That's the thing, though. 1995, underrated movie year. People forget.
Let's just list a few. Heat, 7, Braveheart, Apollo 13, Toy Story, Clueless, Casino, Babe, GoldenEye, Dead Presidents, 12 Monkeys, even Tommy Boy.
It was chaos. You could see Kevin Spacey get arrested, a pig win an Oscar, and Val Kilmer as a hot ghost Batman all in the same year.
It's like every studio said, what if we dropped all the legendary stuff in one calendar year and let Gen X deal with it?
And Crimson Tide still held its ground. That's how strong this movie was. It didn't need superheroes or CGI monsters. It just needed claustrophobia, yelling, and sweat.
It's peak 90s competent cinema, that era when middle-budget thrillers got Oscar-level talent and exploded in theaters.
Right? Crimson Tide is from that magical time when a movie about two guys in a room yelling could open at number one, and you left the theater changed and also kinda thirsty. Okay, I have a question, and I need honest answers only.
Oh boy.
This already feels like a trap.
Which 1995 movie would make the better submarine thriller, Heat or Seven?
Oh, wow. That's actually hard.
It's Heat. Obviously Heat. It's already about two guys circling each other with maximum respect and inevitable destruction. Now put them in a sub and replace the bank with a nuclear payload. Done. We've improved cinema.
Okay, but SC7N on a sub? Now it's claustrophobic horror. You don't know who's doing it. There's a killer on board. One guy keeps finding grisly messages written in condensation on the sub walls. And, you know, Kevin Spacey would be hiding in the torpedo bay for dramatic effect.
All right. Heat gives us dueling captains. Pacino is Ramsey. De Niro is Hunter. The heist is the launch. And the coffee shop scene becomes them debating nuclear ethics over freeze-dried chili mac.
And they never raise their voices.
Whereas C7N gives you murder mystery at 20,000 leagues. Gwyneth's head isn't in a box. It's in a sealed supply locker labeled classified.
Oh my God.
What's in the hatch?
Yes! And Morgan Freeman narrating sonar logs? You know that's gold. Day 6, morale is low. Someone smeared envy on the bulkhead again.
I hate how compelling this is and how deeply cursed.
Okay, compromise. Make Heat the first half of the movie. Everyone's tactical, cool, obsessed with procedure. Then C energy kicks in, and the sub goes full psychological horror.
Yes, it's Heat until the reactor malfunctions. Then it's 7, as everyone starts losing their grip on reality, and no one trusts who has the launch key.
Final shot, De Niro opens the last torpedo tube, and it's Kevin Spacey, just sitting there, smiling.
Cut to black, Zimmer goes nuclear.
I would watch that 10 times in theaters, minimum. Okay. Wait. Let's ask the big question. Why do submarine movies hit so hard? Like, what is it? Why do we keep coming back to metal tubes full of emotionally repressed men yelling about chain of command?
Because they're pressure cookers. Every single one is high-stakes therapy in a sardine can. There's no escape. You can't just walk out of the conflict. You're literally underwater.
It's cinematic anxiety. They should teach submarine movies an intro to panic attacks. Welcome to Psych 101. Today we're watching Das Boot. Try not to cry.
But even bad submarine movies are kind of great. Like, you could hand me a 2006 Hallmark original about a haunted sub, and I'd be like, yeah, sure, let's fire up the ballast tanks and confront our emotional ghosts.
It's also the sound design. Every sub movie has that low hum in the background, the blinking lights. The metal creaks like the ship is constantly thinking about whether it wants to kill you.
And the radio static. Why is radio static scary in a submarine? Like, I get a dropped signal in my car and I just go, meh. But in a submarine? Oh no. The radio cut out. I guess we'll just guess if we should start World War III?
Yes, it's always, we received half a message. It could be abort launch, or it could be give the dog the con. We just don't know.
The thing is, submarine movies are time bombs, every single one. And it's not a question of will something go wrong. It's how fast and how sweaty and how many buttons get pressed while someone yells, give me confirmation.
Also, and I say this with love and fear, submarine movies are weirdly theatrical. Like, I swear Crimson Tide could just be two guys in folding chairs on stage shouting monologues into a fog machine.
And it would still slap. Just Hackman in a spotlight, holding a clipboard like it's a holy relic.
You ever seen a Leipzig-Zahner stallion under pressure, Lieutenant?
I would pay to see that play, no set. Just an LED light that flickers every time someone doubts the chain of command.
And a mini fridge full of pepperoni pizza for the dog. Every act break, someone just tosses him a slice like, this is the only true innocent here.
I still can't get over the fact that the dog is just there, like, no explanation. The captain just brought a dog to a nuclear submarine.
That dog was closer to the nuclear football than most vice presidents, and he's just sitting there like, bark. Mutiny smells different today.
I need a backstory. I need to know what this dog has seen. I want a HBO limited series called Snaps. 6 episodes. Each one starts with the same line. There are no good guys underwater.
You know what kills me, though? Half these sub movies are about missile launches, but nobody ever checks the Wi-Fi signal. It's always like, sir, we lost contact. And I'm like, well, maybe submarines shouldn't rely on satellite emails during Armageddon decisions.
Imagine trying to reconnect your submarine radio like it's a Bluetooth speaker. Sir, do we press and hold the launch console? No, you have to double tap the nuke key while thinking about regret.
And then Gandolfini just unplugged the router because he doesn't trust the internet.
That's the vibe. Everyone on that boat is either ready for war or emotionally constipated from 3 decades of unchecked Cold War trauma.
Or both.
Okay, wait, now that we've broken it all down, I gotta say it. I think submarines are just haunted metaphors for toxic masculinity.
Okay, you need to explain that, because I'm 90% on board and 10% terrified.
I already agree. It's a metal tube of male panic where emotions are explicitly forbidden. That's not allegory. That's therapy homework.
Think about it. Submarine movies are always about dudes who refuse to talk about their feelings until they're one sonar ping away from annihilation.
You're right. Every argument in these movies is really just a repressed man yelling, it's not about the launch code. It's about you not respecting me, Dad. I mean, sir.
They don't sleep, they don't eat, they don't decompress, literally or emotionally, and they definitely don't cry. They just sweat through their uniforms and glare at each other in hallways.
The entire third act of Crimson Tide is just two worldviews slamming into each other while everyone pretends it's about procedure.
Every character is one monologue away from a full-blown emotional breakthrough. But instead, they're like, sir, I respectfully disagree with your interpretation of strategic doctrine when they really mean, why did you stop coming to my little league games?
They can't go anywhere. They're trapped inside their own mental hulls. And it's like, how many times can you tighten a valve before you realize you're the one leaking?
Yes, yes. Submarine movies are interior. They're not about depth charges. They're about emotional pressure building from decades of generational denial.
And no one ever learns, because every time they finally open up, the movie ends.
Exactly. No post-mutiny therapy session. No. Hey, Hunter, want to talk about how it felt to almost start a war because you had to outmaneuver your militarized father figure? Nope. Just, good job, son. Cue Zimmer.
I swear, if Crimson Tide had one scene of group therapy where everyone just sits in a circle and talks about their nuclear nightmares, I'd cry forever and then rewatch it.
And you know the dog would be the emotional grounding presence, just sitting in the corner like, y'all need to get your lives together. I saw what you almost did.
Dog's name is Snaps. Because every time someone's ego snaps, he's there, watching, judging, ready with a slice of pizza and a single bark of truth.
Honestly, every submarine movie is a haunted house where the ghosts are unresolved masculinity. The ghosts don't say boo. They say, follow the chain of command. Okay, real quick, before we get back into sweaty moral brinkmanship and launch code anxiety, let's play a game where you...
Is this about submarine movies?
Or like, submarine sandwiches again? Because I swear, if you try to pit Jersey Mike's versus Quiznos in a Cold War metaphor one more time...
No, trust me. This is relevant. It ties directly into Crimson Tide, kind of.
That means absolutely nothing coming from you.
Welcome to Silver Surfer Trivia.
What?
I knew it. I knew you were going to do this. You said, let's keep it on topic, and then wham, cosmic skateboarding sadness.
This is in the movie, Jeff. It's Tarantino canon. They almost launch a missile over Galactus debate etiquette.
I thought this was going to be a game about Gene Hackman's military career. Like, which of his characters should legally have access to nuclear weapons? That I could have prepared for.
I would have failed that, too. But at least I know how to recognize Hackman when he's yelling.
Nope. This is Silver Surfer Trivia. It's time to test your worthiness as comic book scholars and pop culture survivalists. Question one. First question, what's the Silver Surfer's real name?
Silverius Chromeheart.
No, wait. It's Dave, or Chad Surfman. Shred Radisson.
Wrong. It's Norrin Rad. He is an alien from the planet Zenla who sacrifices everything to save his people by becoming a cosmic herald of doom.
That sounds like an AI-generated college essay.
That sounds like the guy who tells you your car will be ready in 30 minutes, but it never is.
Question two. Next question. Who gave the Silver Surfer his powers?
That's Galactus. Boom.
Correct. He was turned into the Herald of Galactus, the guy who flies ahead and finds planets for dinner.
Wait, he's a cosmic Yelp reviewer?
Yes. He's Galactus's intergalactic delivery scout. He shows up and is like, my lord, this one has mountains and jazz. Okay, so question three. Next one. What is Silver Surfer's primary mode of transportation?
A surfboard.
I still don't believe that. That's not transportation, that's a lifestyle choice.
It is 100% canon. He flies through the vacuum of space on a silver surfboard powered by the power cosmic.
That's not even science fiction. That's a Mountain Dew commercial with theological implications.
Question four, bonus round. True or false? At one point in the comics, Silver Surfer punches Galactus in the face.
False. That sounds like Reddit fanfic.
True. That's exactly how every anime arc ends. Someone punches their cosmic boss in the mouth and then has feelings.
Correct. True. There's an entire arc where Silver Surfer absorbs cosmic energy, rebels, and just smacks Galactus right in the celestial jawline.
That is a workplace violation.
That is career-ending behavior, unless you're on a surfboard. Okay, but why is this in Crimson Tide?
Because Tarantino wrote uncredited dialogue that added comic book tension to Cold War dread. This movie literally pivots on who knows more about Jack Kirby's philosophy.
So the world nearly ends over Silver Surfer trivia.
And now this show has two.
When that is what makes it cinema. So just to recap, we almost triggered a nuclear launch over Silver Surfer trivia. We've created an entire Saturday morning cartoon where Snaps the dog has top secret submarine clearance. And now I think it's time we talk about the man holding this entire movie together with pure, unfiltered, growling authority, Gene Hackman.
Finally, the Hackman reckoning.
Oh, yeah. Let's go deep, like pressure cracking the hull deep, because Hackman in the 1990s was a cinematic institution. He was everywhere. He was yelling. He was glowering. He was walking into scenes like he just ended a Cold War in the hallway.
He has that presence. Like, you walk into a movie and Hackman's already there, arms crossed, disappointed, morally compromised, and holding a file folder.
He always looks like someone just questioned his authority at brunch.
There's something about his 1990s energy. He's not playing the president or the general. He's playing the guy who threatens those people and gets results anyway.
In Crimson Tide, he is a tactical menace in a folding chair, just sitting there, feeding pizza to a dog, whispering about horses, and somehow, it's intense. You're like, oh no, we're going to war, and the dog's coming.
He's not even mean, really. He's just like, you should have read the policy manual, Lieutenant. And also, I already launched the missile.
Like, I want to argue with him, but also I don't because I fear him.
Enter Hackman's 90s dominance. Listen to this run. Ready? Between 1993 and 2001, you get The Firm, Crimson Tide, The Quick and the Dead, Get Shorty.
Yes.
Extreme Measures, Enemy of the State, Behind Enemy Lines, Heist.
Welcome to Mooseport.
Ha, 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 ha.
And there it is.
No, no, I really can't. We're not doing the Mooseport discourse again.
Too late. It's part of the arc.
He goes from morally conflicted submarine commander to president who quits to play golf. It's the full Hackman spectrum.
We should have ranked his roles by military clearance. Like captain, general, rogue analyst, golfer, Santa.
Wait, hang on. Back it up. Let's talk enemy of the state. Because that is where Hackman just goes full ghost.
Off the grid, paranoid wizard energy. He's like, I built this Faraday cage out of vending machine parts, don't ask questions.
And he does not smile once. His entire performance is just controlled panic and microwave static.
It's beautiful. He plays it like he's been hiding in a Circuit City since 88, just waiting for Will Smith to show up with a surveillance problem.
An enemy of the state is such a pivot from Crimson Tide. Like, here he's all, we must follow the protocol, Lieutenant. And then, in the next movie, he's literally climbing air ducts with a homemade radio helmet and screaming about satellites.
It's Hackman unplugged, Hackman unshaved, Hackman with three decoy identities and a backup identity hidden inside a toaster.
He goes full grizzled, like grizzled to the bone. He looks like he eats lithium for breakfast. Will Smith shows up like, hey, I'm being tracked. And Hackman's already 12 chess moves ahead and living in a fallout shelter inside an abandoned footlocker.
And again, it's Tony Scott. So everything's shot, like the camera just ran through a satellite dish made of adrenaline.
And everyone in the government is like a tech-savvy creep in a blazer, just zooming in on Will Smith's khakis from low orbit.
It's surveillance thriller chaos, exploding bagels, exploding vans, John Voight's stress levels.
Seth Green's there. Jack Black is there. It's like the NSA raided a stand-up comedy club and gave everyone headsets.
You know, it's a Tony Scott movie when half the tension is conveyed through rapid edits of fax machines.
So yeah, that's next week. We're diving headfirst into Enemy of the State. Paranoia, pagers, pizza boxes with microphones in them. Hackman screaming from inside a Faraday cage made of coat hangers.
And Will Smith trying to hold on to his marriage, his pants, and his constitutional rights.
I love that movie. It's insane. It's stylish. It's way too loud. It's perfect.
Unless we do Get Shorty.
Absolutely not.
Unless we do Mooseport.
You shut your mouth.
We are covering Enemy of the State like professionals. We've got Hackman data. We've got satellite clips. We've got a running theory about John Voight being the Zodiac.
And I have a spreadsheet about Hackman's jacket sizes by decade.
See? This is already journalism. So next week, treason, tracking devices, and two men yelling from opposite ends of the techpocalypse. Enemy of the State.
Bring your tinfoil.
And a decoy pager.
See you there. So now we've covered everything. The plot, the monk music, the dog with top secret clearance. We played Silver Surfer trivia and somehow learned nothing. We spiraled into Gene Hackman's entire military to mustache pipeline. And now it's time to resurface.
Yeah, I need air. I've been emotionally holding my breath for 90 minutes.
This was a full descent. We started at, oh, hey, a submarine thriller, and ended at, how many jackets has Hackman worn in government buildings?
That's called cinematic integrity. That's the rewind or die guarantee.
Honestly, if someone tuned in for a serious breakdown of naval ethics, I hope they stayed for Snaps the Dog, Herald of Democracy.
Snaps is canon now. There's no turning back.
I feel like this whole episode was one slow zoom into Hackman's soul. And it turns out his soul is a steel corridor full of barked orders and slow-building synths.
And pizza grease.
And classified regrets.
Yes, all of it. The full Hackman. We went there, and next week we're going deeper. Because Enemy of the State isn't just a movie. It's a prophecy. It's a warning. It's a documentary that took place 5 years early in Tony Scott's basement.
And Hackman returns in full goblin mode.
Dude builds a surveillance-proof command center out of, like, 1994 printer parts, and shame.
It's chaos. It's amazing. It's loud. And you're gonna love it.
Are we done? Did we talk about everything?
Almost. We never circled back to Denzel's posture.
Oh my God. Yes! That man stands like he knows what the missiles are thinking.
He stands like he could disarm a warhead just by furrowing his brow.
He stands like the Constitution is watching.
Okay, now we're done. This has been Rewind or Die. One boat, two legends, zero chill. We survived the moral depth charges, the pizza diplomacy, and Gene Hackman's gravel voice shaking loose the rivets in the hull. Next week, we're running from satellites. We're punching data streams. We're going full surveillance state panic. It's Enemy of the State. We'll see you then. And remember, folks, don't trust the government. All right, if you somehow survived all of that, make sure you like, subscribe, scream into the algorithm, whatever works. New episodes drop every Monday. And we've got Rewind or Die shorts coming every Thursday. So you're getting double doses of this chaos every week. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and yes, even X. We are everywhere. Your aunt shares minion memes and your ex posts cryptic quotes about loyalty. Thanks for listening. We'll see you Thursday. Do not miss it.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Producer Steve hopes you have enjoyed this program.